Last time I was here, it was so bad you would be crying by now. I haven't been up to Mount Elgon in years. Not since I was a kid, really. My old man had a friend who had a shamba up there. Shamba. A farm. And we used to visit him all the time. Oh, it was lovely, man. That farm is gone now. Eh? It's Quisha. Quisha. Finished. He dodged around a herd of goats, using his horn liberally. Get out of the way, man, he shouted at a goat. Look, he's not even moving. The Land Rover roared and accelerated. The road passed through small cornfields. In the middle of each plot stood a hut made of mud or cement. People stooped among the cornstalks, hand-tilling their fields with mattocks. Every inch of land lay under cultivation, right up to the doors of the houses. We passed a man standing by the road, holding a suitcase tied up with string. He waved to us. We passed another man wearing an English raincoat and a fedora hat, and carrying a stick, walking slowly. A gray figure in bright sun. Some people waved as we passed, and others turned around in their tracks and stared at us. We stopped to wait for a herd of cattle crossing the road, driven by Kikuyu boys holding switches.
Aye, Robin said dreamily. When I was a kid, to get anywhere in this country was a 3-day trip. We shot a bloody Thompson's gazelle and lived off the thing the whole time. In the old days, 20 years ago, this land was all forest and grassland. Now it's corn. Everywhere, corn. And the forests are gone, man.
Robin MacDonald is a professional hunter and safari guide. He's one of about 2 dozen professional hunters who are left in East Africa. They take clients into the bush to hunt big game. He has a broad, ruddy face, thin lips, piercing eyes behind eyeglasses, and broad cheekbones. He has black curly hair that hangs in pieces around his forehead, looking like he chopped it off with a knife. For walking in the bush, he wears a baseball cap, a black t-shirt, shorts, a curved African knife at his belt, and scorched, melted green sneakers, dried too many times over campfires. He's the son of a famous professional hunter named Ian MacDonald, who was killed at the controls of a light plane that crashed on the African plains in 1967, when Robin was 13. By that time, Robin had learned what he needed to know. He'd hunted leopard and lion with his father, and he'd already shot his first charging Cape buffalo while his father stood beside him to make the backup shot in case he missed. Robin tracked elephant with his father for days through the dry thorn bush of the Yatta Plateau, carrying nothing but a canteen of water and one apple.
That client? He was a guy from Texas, that guy, Robin explained. He said he could walk it no problem, said he was an experienced hunter. He sat down one day and said, "To hell with this. I can't go on. Make me a camp." So we made him a camp, and we went on, my old man and I, and we stalked the elephant for 2 days. My old man only took water when he was tracking an elephant, said to me, "Stuff an apple in that pack, and we'll be off." And then we walked across the Yatta Plateau for 2 days. When we found the elephant, we led the client to it, and he shot it.
How old were you then?
7, man.
He doesn't hunt elephants anymore. He approves of the current worldwide ban on ivory. But he does hunt Cape buffalo, which is not an endangered species. There'd been reports of tribal violence around Mount Elgon. The Elgon Maasai had been raiding the Bukusu, an ethnic group whose people live on the southern side of the mountain, and had been burning their huts, shooting them with automatic weapons and driving them off their land. I was concerned about the situation and had telephoned Robin from the United States to ask him his opinion.
"Where do you want to go? Mount Elgon?" he said.
His voice sounded hissy and remote on the line. "I'm bringing a couple of space suits with me," I said.
"Whatever, my man."
"Is it safe to travel around Mount Elgon?"
No hassle. Not unless there's a bloody uproar.
He lighted a cheap African cigarette and glanced at me. So what are your plans for the cave? Are you going to collect any specimens? Any boxes of bat shit or the like?
No, I just want to look around. I used to go up to that cave when I was a kid, he said. So there's a disease up there, eh? Makes AIDS look like a sniffle, eh? You turn into soup, eh? You explode, eh? Psst! Coming out of every hole, is that the story? And how long does it take?
About 7 days.
Man, how do you get it?
By touching infected blood. It may also be airborne. It's also sexually transmitted.
Like AIDS, you mean?
Yes. The testicles swell up and turn black and blue.
What? Your gullywhackers blow up? Lovely. So you get balls like a blue monkey. Christ. Man, that is a bloody shit, that one.
You have given a good description of the agent, I said. Robin breathed his cigarette. He removed the baseball cap from his head and smoothed his hair and replaced the cap.
Right then. You'll go inside the cave and have a look at bat shit. And then, after you explode in one of my tents, what shall I do with you?
Don't touch me. You could get very sick if you touch me. Just roll up the tent with me inside it and take the thing to a hospital. He crinkled with laughter.
Right. We'll call in the flying doctors. They'll pick up anything. And which hospital shall we have you delivered to, eh?
Nairobi Hospital. Leave me by the casualty entrance.
Right, my man. That's what we'll do.
The Cherangani Hills appeared in the distance, a line of mountains on the edge of the rift, humpy and green, crushed under an indwelling sweep of rain clouds. The clouds darkened and gathered together as we approached Mount Elgon, and splats of rain began to hit the windshield. The air turned cold and raw. Robin turned on his headlights.
"Did you find some bleach?" I asked him. "I've got a gallon in back."
"Plain laundry bleach?"
"Right. We call it Jik here in Kenya. Bloody Jik."
"Is it like Clorox?"
"Right. Jik. Drink it, and it will bloody kill you."
"I hope it kills Marburg." The country grew more settled, and we passed through towns. Everywhere we saw overlander trucks parked in front of shacks made of planks and metal. They were small restaurants. Some of them were full-service establishments, offering grilled goat, Tusker beer, a bed, and a woman. Medical doctors who work in East Africa believe that 90% of the prostitutes working along the main roads carry the AIDS virus. No one knows for sure, but local doctors think that as many as 30% of all men and women of childbearing age who live in the vicinity of Mount Elgon are infected with HIV. Most of them will die of AIDS. Many of their newborn children will also contract AIDS and die of the virus in childhood. The emergence of HIV was subtle. It incubates for years in a human host before it kills the host. If the virus had been noticed earlier, it might have been named Kinshasa Highway, in honor of the fact that it passed along the Kinshasa Highway during its emergence from the African forest. When I rode along the Kinshasa Highway as a boy, it was a dusty, unpaved thread that wandered through the Rift Valley toward Lake Victoria, carrying not much traffic. It was a gravel road engraved with washboard bumps and broken by occasional pit-like ruts that could crack the frame of a Land Rover. As you drove along it, you would see in the distance a plume of dust growing larger, coming towards you. An automobile. You would move to the shoulder and slow down, and as the car approached, you would place both hands upon the windshield to keep it from shattering if a pebble thrown up by the passing car hit the glass. The car would thunder past, leaving you blinded in yellow fog. Now the road was paved and had a stripe painted down the center, and it carried a continual flow of vehicles. The overlanders were mixed up with pickup trucks and vans jammed with people, and the road reeked of diesel smoke. The paving of the Kinshasa Highway affected every person on Earth, and turned out to be one of the most important events of the 20th century. It has already cost at least 10 million lives, with the likelihood that the ultimate number of human casualties will vastly exceed the deaths in the Second World War. In effect, I had witnessed the crucial event in the emergence of AIDS, the transformation of a thread of dirt into a ribbon of tar. Camp. Robin's wife, Carrie MacDonald, is his business partner, and she often accompanies him on safaris with clients. The MacDonalds also bring along their two small sons, if the client will allow that. Carrie's in her 20s, with blonde hair and brown eyes and a crisp English accent. Her parents brought her to Africa from England when she was a girl. We traveled in two Land Rovers, Carrie driving one and Robin driving the other. "We always take two vehicles in this country, in case one breaks down," Carrie explained. "It happens literally all the time." Carrie and Robin's two boys rode with Carrie. We were also accompanied by three men who were members of the MacDonald's safari staff. Their names are Katana Chege, Herman Ondembe, and Morris Mulacha. They are professional safari men, and they do most of the work around the campsite. They spoke very little English and had resumes as long as one's arm. In addition to those people, two friends of mine had joined the expedition. One was a childhood friend named Frederick Grant, and the other was a woman named Jamie Buchanan. Both are Americans. I'd prepared a written list of instructions for my friends in case I broke with Marburg, and I had sealed the document in an envelope and hidden it in my backpack. It ran for 3 pages, typewritten, single-spaced, describing the signs and symptoms of a filovirus infection in a human being, as well as possible experimental treatments that might arrest the terminal meltdown. I hadn't told my friends about this envelope, but I planned to give it to them if I came down with a headache. This was a sign of nervousness, to say the least. Robin turned into the opposite lane in order to pass a truck, and suddenly we were headed straight for an oncoming car. Its headlights flashed, and its horn wailed. Fred Grant grabbed the seat and shouted, "Why is this guy coming at us?"
"Yeah, well, we're going to die, so don't worry about it," Robin remarked.
He dodged in front of the truck, just in time. He blurted out a song, "Livin' and a lovin', and a lovin' and a livin', yah." We stopped and bought roasted ears of corn from a woman standing by the side of the road with a charcoal brazier. The corn was hot, dry, scorched, and delicious, and it cost 5 cents. It was called a mealie. Robin chewed his mealie as he drove. Suddenly he grabbed his jaw and swore violently.
"My tooth! Bloody hell! A filling came out! This arsehole of a bloody dentist!"
He rolled down his window and spat corn into the wind. "Well, carry on. 3 fillings, and they've all come out now. Carrie sent me to the man. Said he was a good dentist. Ha!" He floored his Land Rover until it hovered behind Carrie's Land Rover. The two vehicles were roaring down the highway as if they were attached to each other. He leaned out the window and hurled his gnawed mealie at his wife's Land Rover. It bounced off her rear window. She didn't seem to notice. We passed a sign that said, "Reduce road carnage. Drive safely." Toward sunset, we stopped in the town of Kitale, at the base of Mount Elgon, to buy Tusker beers and charcoal. Kitale is a market town. The main market is situated along the highway leading into town, near an old train station built by the English. The highway is lined with towering blue gum trees. Under the trees On pounded dirt and among mud puddles from fresh rains, people set up stands for selling umbrellas and plastic wristwatches. Robin turned his Land Rover into the market and drove slowly through the crowds. A man shouted in Swahili, "You are driving the wrong way." "Where are the signs?" Robin shouted back. "We don't need signs here." We parked and walked through the town, and instantly we were surrounded by pimps. One guy wore a white ski parka and said, "Do you want to go to Kigawera?" "Yes, I will take you there. Come with me, right now. Beautiful girls, I will take you there." That might be the neighborhood where Charles Monet's girlfriends had lived. It was rush hour, and crowds flowed on foot under the gum trees, past an endless line of small shops. Mount Elgon brooded over the town and the trees, rising to an undefined height, its profile buried in an anvil thunderhead, bathed in golden light. An edge of the mountain razored diagonally upward into the cloud. A silent flash traveled around the mountain, followed by another flash. Chain lightning, but no thunder reached the town. The air was cold, heavy, wet, and filled with the sound of crickets. In our explorations on mud roads around Mount Elgon, we saw signs of the recent trouble. Burned empty huts that had once belonged to Bukusu farmers. Someone had warned me that we would hear gunfire at night, but we didn't. Sickly banana trees leaned around the abandoned huts. The huts stood in fallow fields, strewn with African weeds and shoots of young saplings. We made a camp in the same meadow where Charles Monet had camped. The cook, Morris Mulacha, dumped a sack of charcoal on the ground and built a fire, and put a metal teapot on it to heat water for tea. Robin MacDonald sat down on a folding chair and removed his sneakers. He rubbed his feet with his hands and then drew his knife from its sheath and began paring bits of skin from his toes. Not far away, at the edge of the forest that ringed our campsite, a Cape buffalo eyed us. Robin eyed the buffalo. "That's a male," he muttered. "Those are bastards. You've got to watch them. They'll lift you. The Cape buffalo have killed more human beings in Africa than any other animal, except hippo. Those swine have killed more." I knelt in the grass and organized a row of boxes that contained spacesuits, decontamination gear, and lights. Smoke from the campfire curled in the air, which was filled with the clink-clank noise of safari tents being erected by the McDonald's staff. Carrie MacDonald worked around the campsite, getting things organized, speaking Swahili to the men. A nearby stream tumbled out of a glade. Robin looked up, listening to birds. "Hear that? Those are turicos. And there's a wood hoopoe. And there's a gray mouse bird. Do you see that long tail?" He wandered down to the stream. I followed him. "I wonder if there's any trout in here," he said, staring into the water. "This could be good for fly fishing." I put my hand into the water. It was ice cold and bubbly, but gray in color, clouded with volcanic dust, not the kind of water that would sustain trout. "Talk about fly fishing. Did you ever hear of fly fishing for crocodiles?" Robin said. "No." "You put a piece of meat on a chain, a piece of meat this big, and the flies are all over the place. Now, there's some fly fishing. They stink, those crocodiles. You'll be standing in shallow water, and they'll swim up on you, and the water is muddy, and you can't see them, and unless you can smell them, you don't know they're there, and then, pfft, they drag you down." End of story. "Your history, my man. Talk about nature. The whole thing, if you think about it, is full of killers, from the river to the sea." A young man in a beret and military fatigues knelt on one knee in the grass, holding a Russian assault rifle. watching us with mild interest. His name was Polycarp Okuku, and he was an askari, an armed guard.
"Iko Simba Hapa," Robin called to him. "Any lions around here?"
"Hakuna Simba." No lions left. Poachers from Uganda had been coming over Mount Elgon and shooting anything that moved, including people. And now the Kenyan government required that visitors to Mount Elgon be accompanied by armed guards. The Swahili word askari used to mean spear-bearer. Now it means a man who carries an assault rifle and who walks in your shadow. Kitum Cave opens in a forested valley at an altitude of 8,000 feet on the eastern slope of the mountain.
"Whoof!"
MacDonald said as we grunted up the trail.
"You can smell the Cape buffalo around here, eh? Mingi buffalo."
Mingi. Many. Lots of buffalo. Buffalo trails crossed the human trail on diagonals. The trails were wider, deeper, straighter, more businesslike than the human trail, and they reeked of buffalo urine. I was wearing a backpack. I picked my way across muddy spots in the trail. Polycarp Okuku yanked a lever on the barrel of his assault rifle. Clack tachok. This action cocked the weapon and slotted a round into the firing chamber. "Especially in the rainy season, the Cape buffalo like to travel in herds," he explained. The sound of a machine gun being cocked brought Robin to attention.
"Bloody hell," he muttered. "That toy he's carrying isn't safe."
"Look," Okuku said, pointing to a clump of boulders. "Hyrax." We watched a brown animal about the size of a woodchuck run silkily down the rocks. A possible host of Marburg virus. The valley was cloaked in African olive trees, African cedars, broad-leaved croton trees, Hagenia abyssinica trees drenched in moss, and whip-like young gray Elgon teaks. Here and there grew an occasional podocarpus tree, with a straight silvery shaft that thrust upward to an incredible height and vanished in the shifting green of biological space. This was not lowland rainforest, where the crowns of trees merge into a closed canopy, but an African montane rainforest, a particular kind of forest with a broken canopy, penetrated by holes and clearings. Sunlight fell in shafts to the forest floor, washing over glades where nettles and papyrus sparkled with wild violets. Each tree stood in a space of its own, and the branches zigzagged against the clouds and sky like arms reaching out for heaven. From where we stood, we could see farms on the lower slopes of the mountain. As the eye moved from the lowlands to the uplands, the farms gave way to patches of shrubby trees, to fingers and clumps of larger trees, and then to an unbroken blanket of primeval East African rainforest, one of the rarest and most deeply endangered tropical forests on the planet. The color of the forest was a silvery gray-green from the olive trees, yet here and there a dark green podocarpus tree burst through the canopy. A podo tree's shaft is lightly fluted and goes straight up, without branches, sometimes spiraling as it goes, and there may be a slight swing or curve in the shaft, which gives the tree a look of tension and muscularity, like a bent bow. High up, the podo tree flares into a vase-shaped crown, like an elm tree, and the downhanging limbs are draped with bundles of evergreen leafy needles and are spangled with ball-shaped fruit. The podos were hard to see in the thickets near Kitum Cave, because they didn't grow large in that valley. But I noticed a young podo that was 7 feet thick and close to 100 feet tall. I guessed it had begun to grow in the time of Beethoven.
"What's missing here is the game," Robin said.
He stopped and adjusted his baseball cap, surveying the forest.
The elephants have been all shot to shit. If they hadn't been shot, man, you'd see them all over this mountain. Mingi elephant. This whole place would be elephant.
The valley was quiet, except for the remote ha-ha of colobus monkeys that retreated from us as we climbed. The mountain seemed like an empty cathedral. I tried to imagine what it must have been like when herds of elephants could have been seen moving through a forest of podo trees as large as sequoias. Only 10 years ago, before the trouble, Mount Elgon had been one of the Earth's crown jewels. The mouth of Kitum Cave was mostly invisible from the approach trail, blocked by boulders cloaked in moss. A choir of African cedar trees grew in a row over the mouth of the cave, and a small stream trickled down among the cedars and rained over the boulders, filling the valley with the sound of falling water. As we got closer, the sound of the waterfall grew louder, and the air began to smell of something alive. It smelled of bat. Giant stinging nettles grew in clumps among the boulders, and they brushed against our bare skin and caught our legs on fire. It occurred to me that nettles are, in fact, injection needles. Stinging cells in the nettle inject a poison into the skin. They break the skin. Maybe the virus lives in nettles. Moths and tiny flying insects drifted out of the cave mouth, carried in a steady, cool flow of air. The insects floated like snow blown sideways. The snow was alive. It was a snow of hosts. Any of them might be carrying the virus. Or none of them. We stopped on an elephant trail that led into the cave, beside a wall of rock that was covered with diagonal hatch marks made by the elephants tusking the rocks for salt. The forests of Mount Elgon were home to 2,000 elephants, until the men with machine guns came over from Uganda. Now the Mount Elgon herd has withered to one extended family of about 70 elephants. The poachers set up a machine gun nest at the mouth of Kitum Cave. And after that, the surviving elephants had learned their lesson. The herd stays out of sight as much as possible, concealed in valleys higher on the mountain, and the smart old females, the grandmothers, who are the bosses of the herd and who direct its movements, lead the others to Kitum Cave about once every 2 weeks, when the elephants' hunger for salt overcomes their fear of being shot. Elephants hadn't been the only visitors to Kitum Cave. Cape buffalo had gouged footprints in the trail leading into the cave. I noticed fresh green splats of buffalo dung and waterbuck hoofprints. The trail itself seemed to consist of a bed of dried animal dung. Other than the elephant herd, many different kinds of animals had been going inside Kitum Cave. Bushbuck, red duikers, perhaps monkeys, perhaps baboons, and certainly genet cats, which are wild, cat-like animals, somewhat larger than a house cat. Rats, shrews, and voles go inside the cave, too, either looking for salt or foraging for food. And these small mammals make trails through the cave. Leopards go inside the cave at night, looking for prey. Kitum Cave is Mount Elgon's equivalent of the Times Square subway station. It's an underground traffic zone, a biological mixing point where different species of animals and insects cross one another's paths in an enclosed airspace. A nice place for a virus to jump species. I unzipped my backpack and withdrew my gear and laid it on the rocks. I'd assembled the components of a level 4 field biological spacesuit. It wasn't a pressurized suit, not an orange Raycal suit. It was a neutral pressure, whole-body suit with a hood and a full-face respirator. The suit itself was made of Tyvek, a slick, white fabric that's resistant to moisture and dust. I laid out a pair of green rubber gauntlet gloves, yellow rubber boots, a black mask with twin purple filters. The mask was a silicone rubber North respirator mask with a Lexan faceplate for good visibility, and the purple filters were the kind that stop a virus. The mask had an insectal appearance, and the rubber was black and wet-looking, sinister. I placed a roll of sticky tape on the rocks, a plastic shower cap, 10 cents apiece at Woolworth's. Flashlight, headlamp. I stepped into the suit, feet first, pulled it up to my armpits, and fed my arms into the sleeves. I stretched the shower cap over my head, and then pulled the hood of the suit down over the shower cap. I zipped up the front zipper of the suit from crotch to chin. Generally, you need a support team to help you put on a field biological suit, and my traveling companion, Fred Grant, was acting in this capacity. "Could you hand me the sticky tape?" I said to him. I taped the front zipper of the suit, taped the wrists of my gloves to the suit, taped the cuffs of the boots to the suit. Polycarp Okuku sat on a rock with his gun across his knees, gazing at me with a carefully neutral expression on his face. It was evident that he didn't want anyone to think he was surprised that someone would put on a spacesuit to go inside Katoom Cave. Later, he turned and spoke at length in Swahili with Robin MacDonald. Robin turned to me.
"He wants to know how many people have died in the cave."
"Two," I said. "Not in the cave, they died afterward. One was a man and the other was a boy." Okuku nodded. "There's very little danger," I said. "I'm just being careful." Robin scuffed his sneaker in the dirt. He turned to the askari and said,
"You explode, man. You get it, and that's it. End of story. You can kiss your arse goodbye."
"I have heard about this virus," Okuku said. "There was something the Americans did at this place."
"Were you working here then?" I asked.
"When Gene Johnson and his team came."
"I was not here then," Okuku said. "We heard about it." I fitted the mask over my face. I could hear my breath sucking in through the filters and hissing out through the mask's exhaust ports. I tightened some straps around my head.
"How does it feel?" Fred asked.
"Okay," I said. My voice sounded muffled and distant to my ears. I inhaled. Air flowed over the faceplate and cleared it of fog. They watched me fit an electric miner's lamp over my head.
"How long are you going to be in there?" Fred asked.
"You can expect me back in about an hour."
"An hour?"
"Well, give me an hour."
"Very well. And then?"
he asked.
"And then?"
"Dial 911. The entrance is huge, and the cave widens out from there. I crossed a muddy area covered with animal tracks and continued along a broad platform covered with spongy dried dung. With the mask over my face, I couldn't smell bats or dung. The waterfall at the cave's mouth made splashing echoes. I turned and looked back, and saw that clouds were darkening the sky, announcing the arrival of the afternoon rains. I turned on my lights and walked forward. Katoom Cave opens into a wide area of fallen rock. In 1982, a couple of years after Charles Monnet visited the cave, the roof fell in. The collapse shattered and crushed a pillar that had once seemed to support the roof of the cave, leaving a pile of rubble more than 100 yards across, and a new roof was formed over the rubble. I carried a map inside a plastic waterproof bag. The bag was to protect the map, to keep it from picking up any virus. I could wash the bag in bleach without ruining the map. The map had been drawn by an Englishman named Ian Redmond, an expert on elephants who once lived inside Katoom Cave for 5 months, camping beside a rock near the entrance while he observed the elephants coming and going at night. He wore no biohazard gear and remained healthy. Later, when I told Peter Yarling of USAMRID about Redmond's campout inside Katoom Cave, he said to me in all seriousness, "Is there any way you could get me a little bit of his blood so we can run some tests on it?" It was Ian Redmond who conceived the interesting idea that Katoom Cave was carved by elephants. Mother elephants teach their young how to pry the rocks for salt. Rock carving is a learned behavior in elephants, not instinctive, taught to children by their parents. This knowledge has been passed down through generations of elephants for perhaps hundreds of thousands of years, for perhaps longer than modern humans have existed on the earth. If the elephants have been tusking out the rock of Kitum Cave at a rate of a few pounds a night, the cave could easily have been carved by elephants over a few hundred thousand years. Ian Redmond figured this out. He calls it speleogenesis by elephants, the creation of a cave by elephants. The light began to fade, and the mouth of the cave, behind me, became a crescent of sunlight against the high fallen ceiling. Now the mouth looked like a half moon. I came to a zone of bat roosts. These were fruit bats. My lights disturbed them, and they dropped off the ceiling and flitted past my head, giving off sounds that resembled munchkin laughter. The rocks below the bats were slubbered with wet, greasy guano, a spinach-green paste speckled with gray blobs, which reminded me of Oysters Rockefeller. Momentarily and unaccountably, I wondered what the bat guano would taste like. I thrust away this thought. It was the mind's mischief. You should avoid eating shit when you are in level 4. Beyond the bat roosts, the cave became drier and dustier. A dry, dusty cave is very unusual. Most caves are wet, since most caves are carved by water. There was no sign of running water in this cave, no stream bed, no stalactites. It was an enormous, bone-dry hole in the side of Mount Elgon. Viruses like dry air and dust and darkness, and most of them don't survive long when exposed to moisture and sunlight. Thus, a dry cave is a good place for a virus to be preserved, for it to lie inactive in dung or in drying urine, or even, perhaps, for it to drift in cool, lightless, nearly motionless air. Marburg virus particles are tough. One would imagine they can survive for a fair amount of time inside a dark cave. Marburg can sit unchanged for at least 5 days in water. This was shown by Tom Geisbert. One time, just to see what would happen, he put some Marburg particles into flasks of room temperature water and left the flasks sitting on a countertop for 5 days. The counter was in level 4. Then he took the water and dropped it into flasks that contained living monkey cells. The monkey cells filled up with crystalloids, exploded, and died of Marburg. Tom had discovered that 5-day-old Marburg virus particles are just as lethal and infective as fresh particles. Most viruses don't last long outside a host. The AIDS virus survives for about 20 seconds when exposed to air. No one has ever tried to see how long Marburg or Ebola can survive while stuck to a dry surface. Chances are the thread viruses can survive for some time, if the surface is free of sunlight, which would break apart the virus's genetic material. I came to the top of the mound, reached out with my gloved hand, and touched the ceiling. It was studded with brown, oblong shapes, petrified tree logs, and whitish fragments, pieces of petrified bone. The rock is solidified ash, the relic of an eruption of Mount Elgon. It's embedded with stone logs, the remains of a tropical rainforest that was swept up in the eruption and buried in ash and mud. The logs are dark brown and shiny, and they reflected opalescent colors in the beam of my headlamp. Some of the logs had fallen out of the roof, leaving holes, and the holes were lined with white crystals. The crystals are made of mineral salts, and they looked evilly sharp. Had Peter Cardinal reached up and touched these crystals? I found bats roosting in the holes among the crystals, insect-eating bats, smaller than the fruit bats that clustered near the cave's mouth. As I played my headlamp over the holes, bats exploded out of them and whirled around my head and were gone. Then I saw something wonderful. It was the tooth of a crocodile caught in the rock. The ash flow had buried a river that had contained crocodiles. The crocodiles had been trapped and burned to death in an eruption of Mount Elgon. I shuffled across razor-like slices of rock that had fallen from the roof and came to a fresh elephant dropping. It was the size of a small keg of beer. I stepped over it. I came to a crevice and shone my lights down into it. I didn't see any mummified baby elephants down there. I came to a wall. It was scored with hatch marks, elephant tuskings. The elephants had left scrapes in the rock all over the place. I kept going down and came to a broken pillar. Next to it, a side tunnel continued downward. I wormed into the passage on my knees. It circled around and came out in the main room. I was boiling hot inside the suit. Drops of moisture had collected on the inside of my faceplate and pooled in the mask under my chin. My footsteps kicked up dust, and it rose in puffs around my boots. It felt strange to be soaking wet and yet wading through dust. As I was climbing out of the passage, my head slammed against a rock. If I hadn't been wearing protective gear, the rock would have cut my scalp. It seemed easy to get a head wound in the cave. Perhaps that was the root of infection. The virus clings to the rocks and gets into the bloodstream through a cut. I proceeded deeper until I came to a final wall in the throat of the cave. There, at knee level, in total darkness, I found spiders living in webs. They had left their egg cases scattered about, hanging from the rock. The spiders were carrying on their life cycle at the back of Kitum Cave. That meant they were finding something to eat in the darkness, something that was flying into their webs. I had seen moths and winged insects pouring from the mouth of the cave, and it occurred to me that some of them must be flying all the way to the back. The spiders could be the host. They could catch the virus from an insect in their diet. Perhaps Marburg cycles in the blood of spiders. Perhaps Monet and Cardinal were bitten by spiders. You feel a cobweb clinging to your face, and then comes a mild sting, and after that you don't feel anything. You can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't feel it. You don't know it's there until you start to bleed. So much was happening that I didn't understand. Kitum Cave plays a role in the life of the forest. But what the role is, no one can say. I found a crevice that seemed to be full of clear, deep water. It couldn't be water, I thought. The crevice must be dry. I picked up a stone and threw it. Halfway down in its flight, the stone made a splash. It had hit water. The stone spun lazily downward into the crevice and out of sight, and ripples spread across the pool and died away, throwing reflections of my headlamp onto the wall of the cave. I climbed over fallen plates of stone, back to the top of the rubble pile, playing my lights around. The room was more than 100 yards across, larger in all directions than a football field. My lights failed to penetrate to the edges of the room, and the edges descended downward into darkness on all sides. The mound of rubble in the center made the cave resemble the curving roof of a mouth. As you look into someone's mouth, you see the tongue in front, lying under the roof of the mouth, and you see the tongue curving backward and down into the throat. That is what Kitum Cave looked like. Say, "Ah, Kitum Cave, do you have a virus?" No instruments, no senses can tell you if you are in the presence of the predator. I turned off my lights and stood in total darkness, feeling a bath of sweat trickle down my chest, hearing the thump of my heart and the swish of blood in my head. The afternoon rains had come. Fred Grant was standing inside the mouth of the cave to keep himself dry. The askari sat on a rock nearby, bouncing the machine gun on his knees, looking bored. "Welcome back," Grant said.
Was it good for you? We'll find out in 7 days, I said. He scrutinized me. There appear to be splatters on your face shield. Splatters of what? Looks like water. It's just sweat inside my mask. If you'll bear with me a moment, I'm going to get this suit off. I took a plastic laundry tub, part of the gear we had carried up to the cave, and left it under the waterfall for a moment. When the tub was partly full, I carried it over to the elephant's pathway at the entrance, put it on the ground, and poured in most of a gallon of bloody jick, laundry bleach. I stepped into the tub. My boots disappeared in a swirl of dirt coming off them, and the jick turned brown. I put my gloved hands into the brown jick, scooped up some of the liquid, and poured it over my head and face mask. Using a toilet brush, I scrubbed my boots and legs to remove obvious patches of dirt. I dropped my bag map into the jick. I dropped my flashlight and headlamp into the jick. I took off my face mask and dunked it, along with the purple filters. Then my eyeglasses went into the jick. I peeled off my green gauntlet gloves. They went into the jick. I stepped out of my Tyvek suit, peeling the sticky tape as I went. The whole suit, together with the yellow boots, went into the jick. It was a stew of biohazard gear. Underneath my suit, I wore a set of clothes and a pair of sneakers. I stripped to the skin and put the clothing into a plastic garbage bag, a so-called hot bag, along with a splash or two of jick, and then put that bag into another bag. I washed the outsides of both bags with bleach. From my backpack, I removed a clean set of clothing and put it on. I put the biohazard gear into double bags, adding jick. Robin MacDonald appeared noiselessly in his sneakers at the top of the rocks at the mouth of the cave.
"Sir Batshit," he called. "How did it go?"
We walked down the trail, lugging the hot bags, and returned to camp. The rain intensified. We settled down on chairs in the mess tent with a bottle of Scotch whiskey, while the rain splattered down and hissed through the leaves. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The clouds thickened to the point where the sky grew black, and we lighted oil lamps inside the mess tent. Peals of thunder rolled around the mountain, and the rain turned into a downpour. Robin settled into a folding chair.
"Ah, man, this rain never stops on Elgon. This happens all year round."
There was a stroboscopic flash and a bang, and a lightning bolt whacked an olive tree. The flash outlined his face, his glasses. We chased the scotch with Tusker beers and played a round of poker. Robin declined to join the game.
"Have some whiskey, Robin," Fred Grant said to him.
"None of that for me," he said. "My stomach doesn't like it. Beer is just right. It gives you protein, and you sleep well."
The rain tapered off, and the clouds momentarily lightened. Olive trees arched overhead in squiggles, their feet sunk in shadows. Water drops fell through the halls of trees. Mouse birds gave off flute-like cries, and then the cries stopped, and Mount Elgon became silent. The forest shifted gently, rocking back and forth. Rain began to fall again.
"How are you feeling, Sir Batshit?" Robin said. "Are you getting any mental symptoms? That's when you first start talking to yourself in the toilet. It'll be starting any day now."
The mental symptoms were starting already. I remembered slamming my head into the roof of the cave. That had raised a bump on my scalp. There would be microscopic tears in the skin around that bump. I'd begun to understand the feeling of having been exposed to a filovirus. I'll be okay. No problem. The odds are very good that I wasn't exposed to anything. The emergence of AIDS, Ebola, and any number of other rainforest agents appears to be a natural consequence of the ruin of the tropical biosphere.
The emerging viruses are surfacing from ecologically damaged parts of the Earth. Many of them come from the tattered edges of tropical rainforest, or they come from tropical savanna that is being settled rapidly by people. The tropical rainforests are the deep reservoirs of life on the planet, containing most of the world's plant and animal species. The rainforests are also its largest reservoirs of viruses, since all living things carry viruses. When viruses come out of an ecosystem, they tend to spread in waves through the human population, like echoes from the dying biosphere. Here are the names of some emerging viruses. Lhasa, Rift Valley, Oropouche, Rocio, Q. guanarito, VEE, monkeypox, dengue, chikungunya, the hantaviruses, machupo, hunin, the rabies-like strains Mokola and Duvenhag, Ledantec, the Kiasanur forest brain virus, HIV, which is very much an emerging virus because its penetration of the human species is increasing rapidly with no end in sight. The Semliki forest agent, Crimean Congo, Sinbis, Onyangyang, Nameless Sao Paulo, Marburg, Ebola Sudan, Ebola Zaire, Ebola Reston. In a sense, the Earth is mounting an immune response against the human species. It's beginning to react to the human parasite, the flooding infection of people, the dead spots of concrete all over the planet, the cancerous rot-outs in Europe, Japan, and the United States, thick with replicating primates, the colonies enlarging and spreading and threatening to shock the biosphere with mass extinctions. Perhaps the biosphere does not like the idea of 5 billion humans. Or it could also be said that the extreme amplification of the human race, which has occurred only in the past 100 years or so, has suddenly produced a very large quantity of meat, which is sitting everywhere in the biosphere and may not be able to defend itself against a life form that might want to consume it. Nature has interesting ways of balancing itself. The rainforest has its own defenses. The Earth's immune system, so to speak, has recognized the presence of the human species and is starting to kick in. The Earth is attempting to rid itself of an infection by the human parasite. Perhaps AIDS is the first step in a natural process of clearance. AIDS is arguably the worst environmental disaster of the 20th century. The AIDS virus may well have jumped into the human race from African primates, from monkeys, and anthropoid apes. For example, HIV-2, one of the two major strains of HIV, may be a mutant virus that jumped into us from an African monkey known as the sooty mangabe, perhaps when monkey hunters or trappers touched bloody tissue. HIV-1, the other strain, may have jumped into us from chimpanzees, perhaps when hunters butchered chimpanzees. A strain of simian AIDS virus was recently isolated from a chimpanzee in Gabon, in West Africa, which is so far the closest thing to HIV-1 that anyone has yet found in the animal kingdom. The AIDS virus was first noticed in 1980 in Los Angeles by a doctor who realized that his gay male patients were dying of an infectious agent. If anyone at the time had suggested that this unknown disease in gay men in Southern California came from wild chimpanzees in Africa, the medical community would have collectively burst out laughing. No one's laughing now. I find it extremely interesting to consider the idea that the chimpanzee is an endangered rainforest animal,
and then to contemplate the idea that a virus that moved from chimps is suddenly not endangered at all. You could say that rainforest viruses are extremely good at looking after their own interests. The AIDS virus is a fast mutator. It changes constantly. It's a hypermutant, a shapeshifter, spontaneously altering its character as it moves through populations and through individuals. It mutates, even in the course of one infection, and a person who dies of HIV is usually infected with multiple strains, which have all arisen spontaneously in the body. The fact that the virus mutates rapidly means that vaccines for it will be very difficult to develop. In a larger sense, it means that the AIDS virus is a natural survivor of changes in ecosystems. The AIDS virus and other emerging viruses are surviving the wreck of the tropical biosphere because they can mutate faster than any changes taking place in their ecosystems. They must be good at escaping trouble, if some of them have been around for as long as 4 billion years. I tend to think of rats leaving a ship. I suspect that AIDS might not be nature's preeminent display of power. Whether the human race can actually maintain a population of 5 billion or more without a crash with a hot virus remains an open question. Unanswered. The answer lies hidden in the labyrinth of tropical ecosystems. AIDS is the revenge of the rainforest. It is only the first act of the revenge. No problem, I thought. Of course, I'll be all right. We'll be all right. No problem at all. Everything will be all right. Plenty of people have gone inside Kitum Cave without becoming sick. 3 to 18 days. As the amplification begins, you feel nothing. It made me think of Joe McCormick, the CDC official who had clashed with the Army over the management of the Ebola Reston outbreak. I remembered the story of him in Sudan, hunting Ebola virus. At the end of a plane flight into deep bush, he'd come face to face with Ebola in a hut full of dying patients, had pricked his thumb with a bloody needle, and got lucky, and had survived the experience. In the end, Joe McCormick had been right about the Ebola Reston virus. It had not proved to be highly infectious in people. Then I thought about another Joe McCormick discovery, one of the few breakthroughs in the treatment of Ebola virus. In Sudan, thinking he was going to die of Ebola, he had discovered that a bottle of scotch is the only good treatment for exposure to a filovirus. I drove to the abandoned monkey house one day in autumn to see what had become of it. It was a warm day in Indian summer. A brown haze hung over Washington. I turned off the beltway and approached the building discreetly. The place was deserted and as quiet as a tomb. Out front, a sweet gum tree dropped an occasional leaf. For lease signs sat in front of many of the offices around the parking lot. I sensed the presence not of a virus, but of financial illness. Clinical signs of the 80s, like your skin peeling off after a bad fever. I walked across the grassy area behind the building until I reached the insertion point, a glass door. It was locked. Shreds of silver duct tape dangled from the door's edges. I looked inside and saw a floor mottled with reddish-brown stains. A sign on the wall said, "Clean up your own mess." Next to it, I discerned the airlock corridor, the gray zone through which the soldiers had passed into the hot zone. It had gray cinder block walls, the ideal gray zone. My feet rustled through shreds of plastic in the grass. I found elderberries ripening around a rusted air-handling machine. I heard a ball bounce and saw a boy dribbling a basketball on a playground. The ball cast rubbery echoes off the former monkey house. Children's shouts came from the daycare center through the trees. Exploring the back of the building,
I came to a window and looked in. Climbing vines had grown up inside the room and had pressed against the glass of the windows, seeking warmth and light.